Yes. So our next item, thank you, is item 11, which is the our educational session on the Brown Act, the Ralph M. Brown Open Meeting Act. Here we are. The screen is up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We continue our education theme for this morning with a review of the Ralph M. Brown Act open meetings laws. We'll cover some of the fundamentals and start with slide two, which the slide deck is in the agenda packet for you, and it is up on the screen right now. First, we'll talk about the fact that the SACERA board is governed by the Brown Act in terms of how it is to conduct its meetings. And the purpose of the Brown Act is to ensure that the board's actions are taken openly and that the board's deliberations are as well. As you know, the meetings have to be open and accessible to the public. A board meeting agenda must be posted publicly. And during board meetings, the public must be given an opportunity to comment. The Brown Act defines a meeting to mean a congregation of a majority of the retirement board. In our case, there are nine voting members, so a majority is five, at the same place and location to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item within the retirement board's subject matter jurisdiction. In addition, there could be a meeting that doesn't necessarily happen at the same place and time, and those are referred to as serial meetings, and those are also governed by the Brown Act. So if there is a serial meeting that includes a majority of the board members, that also is subject to the laws that require the meeting to be done publicly with a posted agenda. An example of a serial meeting occurs when Trustee A, for example, will email Trustee B about some item within the board's jurisdiction. And then Trustee B forwards the email to C, then C forwards it to D, and D forwards it to E. Now you have five board members serially having been essentially communicating via email about a subject matter that is within the jurisdiction of the board. And that series of emails is considered a serial meeting and one that should have happened publicly with a posted agenda. And so conducting it in such a way with the serial emails would constitute a violation of the Brown Act. So it's very important to be aware of that if, to the extent you're using emails and text and that kind of thing, to beware of having a serial meeting. Next, we'll cover committee meetings. In addition to full board meetings, the Brown Act also governs committee meetings, and to the extent that there are standing committees of the board, and in the retirement board's case, there is one, and that's the audit committee. The audit committee is subject to the same rules and has to hold its meetings publicly with a posted agenda. There is an exception to that. If there's a committee of the board that is not a standing committee, but instead an advisory committee, that is convened for a limited purpose and a limited duration, it is not subject to the Brown Act and does not have to be conducted publicly. And the Brown Act does allow the board members to attend conferences. If there is a majority of the board members attending, the conference must be open to the public. And the board members attending have to make sure that they are not discussing among themselves business that is SACERA business. And our staff will normally let you know and confirm whether a particular conference is open to the public or not. It doesn't have to be free to the public, but it does have to be open to the public. And an example of that would be the SACRS conference. They do a fall and spring conferences, and those are typically open to the public. And so a majority of the board members may attend without violating the Brown Act. The same goes for social events. A majority of the board can attend a social event, such as a wedding or a funeral. And again, the board members have to be careful not to discuss among themselves SACRA business. On to slide 9, there is a fairly recent law that addresses social media and confirms that participation in social media is also allowed. And again, board members have to be careful not to discuss among themselves a SACRA business item. Slide 10, now we turn to a COVID-19 update to the laws. As you know, the board is meeting today via Zoom, teleconference, and that is allowed. It has been allowed throughout the pandemic. As you recall, in March 2020, the state of California, the governor proclaimed a state of emergency and issued a number of executive orders, one of which allowed boards such as this one to meet virtually without some of the teleconference requirements that are in the Brown Act normally. And so, for example, there isn't a requirement that a quorum of the board members participate from within the county jurisdiction. And there is no requirement to physically post an agenda where you are today and open that location to the public. And so that was the case under the executive order that was issued by the governor. That expired in the fall of 2021. And in its place, we then had a new law, AB 361, which added government code section 54953 subdivision E to the Brown Act. And that essentially allowed the continuation of holding virtual meetings during a state of emergency. This board has utilized that new law in order to continue to meet virtually during the state of emergency. That new law, it does require that every 30 days, the board reconsider the conditions in the county and decide whether to continue to meet virtually or not. On slide 11, we have some details about what the new law requires. It ensures that the public has the opportunity to attend virtually and comment, make public comments, and that they know ahead of time, based on the agenda, how to participate, how to make public comment. The law requires that the agenda state exactly how the members of the public can access the meeting and provide public comment. And the agenda must include an option for the public to attend either telephonically or via an internet-based service option. So on to slide 12. The law does require that the board conduct the meeting in a way that protects the constitutional and statutory rights of the public. If there's a disruption in the public broadcast of the meeting, or there's an inability of technically for the public to make a comment, the board will have to stop the meeting and take no further action until the situation is restored and the public is able to attend, observe, and make comment. And the law does specify that the board may not require public comments to be submitted in advance of the meeting. Instead, the board must allow virtual comments to be submitted in real time, so telephonically or with audio and video, if that's what the member of the public chooses.
Hey, Karen, just to give you a real life example, I just went through a meeting 2 weeks ago in another county for a client. And there was a meeting disruption in the Zoom platform where someone took over the chat, or didn't take over. They went into the chat function and just put some really horrid stuff. I mean, it was like as bad as you can imagine. So the meeting was halted. The tech people tried to figure out what to do. The bottom line was they couldn't figure out how to erase the chat, but they needed to continue the meeting. They had a lot of important business before the council. So they had to continue the meeting while the techies were trying in the background, trying to figure out how to eliminate the visual access of people like me who were not panelists on this meeting to see the chat. And they never did figure it out. So unfortunately, if you wanted to see what the disruption was about, you could look at the chat. It was just horrid. But anyway, it was a real life example of, I just went through it where, you know, a meeting was halted. They tried to figure it out. They felt that they needed to continue with the meeting. They took only the time necessary to try to address it. So the bottom line was it was really disruptive and it ended up, you know, bringing a lot of attention to the very thing that was disruptive, unfortunately, which was what was in the chat. And I don't know, technically, I'd like to think that we would be able to figure it out a little better than they did, but it is what it is, but it's very disruptive.
Yes. Thank you, Scott. That's a really interesting story. And it really illustrates a couple of points that I think everybody has been learning throughout this time. And that is, number one, you really have to have patience and, you know, give it a couple minutes, give it time. If someone's, you can see them, but you can't hear them, give them a minute, just pause and let them try to figure out the technology. And the other thing is to be flexible and, respond to what's happening and things come up, various obstacles and things that are unanticipated come up. And, our staff has to be able to try to figure it out. So between, between having patience and learning how to deal with obstacles, the point is that, you know, the business of the board needs to continue and not be completely halted for a lengthy period of time. And when it comes to holding meetings that are subject to the Brown Act, there needs to be transparency to the public and the ability for the public to observe and participate just like they would if this was an in-person meeting.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Patience is the byword.
Yes.
Yep.
So continuing on with slide 13 under the COVID-19 virtual meeting law, the board also has to allow a reasonable amount of time per agenda item to permit members of the public to comment, including time to register or otherwise be recognized for the purposes of the comment. So again, it shouldn't be held against them if it takes our staff time to put them on and allow them to make comment. Basically, the other thing that I wanted to mention about the new law is that it's temporary. It actually ends at the end of 2023, unless the legislature makes further changes. It is a temporary law, and it applies to any state of emergency that is declared by the governor, not just COVID-19. And so in situations where there might be fires or earthquakes, and this law is still effective, then boards would have the opportunity to decide whether the circumstances dictate that meetings should be held virtually. And again, the purpose is to make sure that boards are able to continue to perform their duties and transact business.
Right. So Karen, hold that thought for a moment. Jerry Holcomb had his hand up. Jerry.
Question on that slide, Karen, 13.
Yes.
A real life scenario we're seeing in some other public meetings and other venues is that there are times when public comment totally degrades into unprofessional shouting matches, name calling, whatever it might be. The second bullet would suggest here that under no circumstances would you be able to close that public comment period. Would there be a provision for someone to be able to make such a decision, a board chair or something in our case, if and when, and I consider it unlikely, but that the discussion would just, to use the vernacular, just get off the rails entirely?
Yes, Jerry, great question. And thankfully, we haven't had to deal with that at CICERA board meetings. But the law does address a situation where an attendee is being disruptive. And it does allow the board to clear that person from the room, physically or virtually. And so I think that to the extent that someone is being disruptive, we have that authority. But when it comes to public comment can be negative, and it can be as negative as the speaker would like it to be. And it still is a valid public comment that the member of the public has the right to make.
So let me jump in though. I think because I don't know if Jerry was getting at a different facet of this, but that if a board or a council has an allotted, so it's agenda item 3 or 4, whatever it is on ours, and it's public comment, and we do have a 3-minute limit, which is reasonable. And if we have 15 people in the queue, and before we get to those 15, all hell breaks loose with a commenter who is completely disruptive and whatnot, what I understand the second bullet to mean is that after we've taken care of the problem, and it sounds likely that we would remove that person virtually from the meeting to stop the disruption, it that might take 20 minutes, right? It might take whatever it takes. And we might be annoyed that we still have 15 people in the queue. What I understand the second bullet to mean is, even with a disruption, after you take care of it, you still have to provide the time for the others to provide public comment. Have I got that right?
Yes, absolutely, okay. Scott. That's a great example. The others in the queue had nothing to do with the disruption, and they are entitled to their time.
Okay, so Jerry,
I recognize that. I don't want to belabor this point, but if there's a series of speakers and they're basically all taking the same negative position and perhaps even an inappropriate position, then are we also obligated to then individually listen to each one of them? Serially and dismiss each one of them individually as their objectionable comments? I don't mean negative. I understand they're perfectly capable of and able to make a negative comment. It's just that if they're totally disruptive to the meeting, at what extent or to what extent and what time would the chair actually have the ability to say, the rest of you, and we're all here for the same reason. You're all doing the same screaming and yelling. And, therefore, we're going to give thought to closing off this comment period.
Well, and if I can just add, we deal with this on the Board of Supervisors, needless to say. I'm not talking about obscene comments. Again, it's usually someone's First Amendment rights to say something that they just really don't like. But we promote people literally for the 2 minutes they're allowed to speak. And at 15 seconds left, our clerk says, you have 15 seconds. And the moment their 2 minutes are up, they're poof, they're no longer promoted. And so you handle the disruption much easier that way by just promoting them for the 2 minutes that starts. And as soon as they're done, they're put back in. I think with technology, you control it a lot better than you do when you're in a live meeting, because people don't always stand down from the podium. And, there are times where we, of course, have to rely upon our sheriff deputies to have someone stop talking. So, but I think you know, when you get that, you've got to balance, even if it's obscene or something else, it's very challenging not to. I say we had a horrible experience on County Connection last week, where we weren't using this platform of having people who are promoted as panelists. And I recall looking to see suddenly a man with a large nose ring popping into the meeting, and then just horrific porn and shouting of horrible racial comments. And so, you know, we just said, everyone exit the meeting. We all exited, went back into the meeting, and they did not try to return, and then set a whole new policy for County Connection that they had to start using panelists. But nevertheless, I think you really never want to quell someone's First Amendment rights, but you can really control their 2 minutes. And if everyone comes in for 2 minutes with disruptive conduct or comments, you just sort of sit there and you smile and put up with it, unless, again, it's something that's so offensive that then I don't know at that point, Karen, if someone really is starting to make horrible racial statements or using extreme profanity. I think our inclination on the Board of Supervisors is to have the person controlling that mute that and just say, you know, we're sorry, but, you know, we can't have that, those comments spoken. But it's a really challenge. First Amendment right and the right to be speaking at a public meeting, that's really, you've got to balance that.
Understood.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
Well, hopefully we won't confront that. As a special purpose agency, we are a little bit removed from the mainstream of public comment.
It's nice that this is purely a hypothetical situation for this board. And I think that goes back to what Harvey said earlier during the fiduciary education session about this particular board and how trustees conduct themselves. And I think that translates also to those who attend, who seem to really try to be respectful to the extent that they can. Okay, so now I'd like to cover on slide 14, the pre-COVID-19 rules about meeting via teleconference, because if you will recall, those rules were in place previously to the pandemic and are still in place. And the board has utilized them here and there where someone was unavailable to come into the meeting in person because they were elsewhere, maybe in another state, and they would call in, teleconference in. And the pre-COVID rules were and still are that if you utilize that method, where you're calling in from essentially becomes a public meeting place, like a satellite public meeting place. You have to post the agenda there physically. It has to be located in a place where the public is able to come and attend the meeting. So that is still the case. Slide 15 addresses voting report requirements. The board must publicly report any action taken and the vote or abstention of each member present for the action. And that is for transparency purposes. The public should have the information about how each board member voted on each particular item. And now we turn to the agenda requirement in the Brown Act, that's on slide 16. At least 72 hours before a regular board meeting, an agenda containing a general description of each item of business to be transacted, including items to be discussed, and the time and location of the meeting must be posted in a public location as well as on the CICERO website. The law also was amended fairly recently to require that the agenda be accessible on the website through a prominent direct link, and that's to avoid a situation where the public is going on the CICERO website and having trouble finding the agenda, having to click on various links and do a search and have trouble finding it. So the law does require there to be a direct link so that the public can easily access the agenda on the website. Slide 17 talks about what happens with items that are not included on the agenda. If an item is not included on the agenda, the board may not act on it, may not discuss it, but there are some limited exceptions. The board may make a brief comment about something that is not on the agenda, or ask for a report from staff, or ask for a study to be conducted, and report back to the board at a future meeting about that item. And the board also may direct staff to place a matter of business on a future agenda. In addition, and that's on slide 18, in some situations, if there is a need to take immediate action on an item that is not on the agenda, and that need for action came to the attention of SACERA subsequent to the agenda being posted, then the board may discuss that item, despite the fact that it's not on the agenda, but only if the board makes those determinations by a two-thirds vote. So the board will make a determination by two-thirds that there's a need to take immediate action on this item that is not on today's agenda, and that the need came to our attention after the agenda was posted. That happens very, very rarely.
So that's a 6-vote supermajority in our scenario?
Yes, that's correct. Slide 19 addresses public comment. And again, during the meeting, the public has to be afforded an opportunity to comment, whether it's an in-person meeting or in today's world with a virtual meeting, we have to allow them the opportunity to make comment. That comment time may be limited, as we mentioned earlier, a reasonable time limit of 3 minutes is what we currently have at SACERA per speaker. Same goes for virtual meetings under the current situation. Slide 20 addresses disruptive attendees, and we talked about that earlier based on some questions and examples that were discussed, that essentially negative public comments must be allowed, but if the meeting is willfully interrupted, the board may clear the room of the disruptive individuals and continue the meetings. And those members of the public that didn't participate in the disturbance must be allowed to stay. On slide 21, we start talking about closed session. Up until now, we talked about open session and allowing the public to attend, observe, make comment. But the Brown Act also prescribes that the board may meet in closed session outside the presence of the public, but only if there's enumerated circumstances in the law, only if those exist, then the closed session is authorized. So for example, for a pension board like this one, the purchase or sale of a particular specific pension fund investment may be done in closed session. But again, that has to relate to a particular investment, not a general direction. In addition, personnel matters, which include disability applications, those can be done in closed session, deliberated and acted on in closed session. In addition, the board may meet to confer with legal counsel regarding litigation in closed session. Moving on to slide 22, more examples of closed sessions that are authorized by the Brown Act. A conference of the board with SACERA's designated representatives regarding employee salaries and benefits. That is allowed to be done in closed session, but the law prohibits the board from taking final action on salaries and benefits in closed session. That has to be done in open session. The Brown Act also allows the board to meet in closed session to discuss employee performance evaluations, but the agenda must disclose the title of the employee, and the session itself in closed session is not allowed to have a discussion on proposed compensation. That cannot be done in closed session. Moving on to slide 23, there is a requirement of a public report with closed sessions, depending on the closed session and what was decided. For example, if the board is meeting in closed session to decide whether to approve or deny a disability application, the board's decision then has to be reported out, and each board member's vote has to be reported. But in other situations, such as conferring with legal counsel on pending litigation matters, there is no requirement to make a public report. In a situation where the board has met in closed session to decide to, for example, purchase a particular investment vehicle, that decision does need to be reported out, but not on that same day, but instead it needs to be disclosed to the public either at the first open meeting of the board held after the earlier or the close of the investment transaction or the transfer of pension fund assets for the investment transaction. So basically after the deal has concluded, the money is transferred, then there needs to be a report to the public of the board's decision and the vote, not before. Slide 24 is a reminder that closed session discussions are confidential. And we end with talking about the consequence of violating the Brown Act. There could be criminal liability for individual board members if they violate the Brown Act. There could be civil remedies if there's a violation of the Brown Act. And basically, the board decision, if it was done in violation of the Brown Act, could be invalidated. And the plaintiff, the person who complains about the Brown Act violation, if they win, then they are entitled to their costs and attorney fees that they incurred in taking the agency to court for a Brown Act violation. So let me end with asking if there's any questions.
Any questions of Karen on the material or anything we discussed?
Karen, on Nowicki, I think all of this is now public. Didn't the Court of Appeals effectively not accept our claim that he was in violation, that he and his board were in violation of the Brown Act?
That was not a Brown Act case. So there was no allegation that Cicera violated the Brown Act. Am I understanding your question correctly, John?
It was the Arinda-Moraga board,
right,
ignoring the Brown Act in allowing him to negotiate privately compensation increases.
This went to the issue of whether what Nowicki did was improper under the statute in terms of the board's and Nowicki's complicity in violating the Brown Act.
Thank you. I understand the question now. In that case, the Court of Appeals decided that whatever the district board did or may have done, and whether they violated the Brown Act or not, is not really impugned to the member who might have benefited from those actions. That's kind of where that case went.
Is there any lesson from what we just learned from you through this overall presentation, based upon what the appellate court decided for Nowicki?
For Cicera, we correctly agendize these closed sessions, and to the extent that there's any changes to employee salaries or benefits, those are done in open session. The board does correctly utilize the closed session authority to meet in closed session with a designated representative to negotiate salaries. So In terms of any lessons, we think that our CSERA's process is correct under the Brown Act.
Okay, I assume that means to some degree we still believe that the what we know of the Moraga Arinda Board's decision was in violation of the Brown Act, but as a practical matter, the appellate court did not see it that way in terms of their final reversal of our decision.
Harvey has his hand up, Karen. So, Harvey, did you want to respond to that?
Only this. The Karen's right. The Court of Appeals said Mr. Nowicki can't be held to have violated the Brown Act. only the agency, the body, could violate the Brown Act. But then it did say something that's a real clunker, in my opinion, which is that, oh, they couldn't have violated the Brown Act because they had an attorney present to counsel them. There's no blanket exception to Brown Act violations simply because you have an attorney present.
Yes.
And so, you know, in my view, the Court of Appeals was just flat wrong on that. So I don't take any lesson from that. Mr. Phillips, I don't take that as a blessing that we could rely on in the future and violate the Brown Act, and simply because you have counsel present, you get a free pass. There's no such thing in my view of the law.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for Karen on the Brown Act? Appears not. Well, thank you, Karen. Very helpful as always.